The growing pains of 5G technology, the growing concerns of vaping, and the growing support in the Bahamas from South Florida. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Miami-Dade County is rushing to build the infrastructure for new 5G technology, but the rollout is not going smooth. We'll hear from one Miami-Dade commissioner who wants telecommunication companies to slow it down a bit. Also, there is a growing number of deaths related to vaping. It's extremely popular with high schoolers. But what do we know about vaping? There's a call for the CDC to do more research. And there are a lot of people trying to get help to those in the Bahamas hardest impacted by Dorian. They're not waiting for the Bahamian government to coordinate. They're just taking stuff there themselves. We'll meet a local fisherman who brought supplies to the islands last weekend. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. We are about to enter the world of 5G. This is supposed to bring a new level of technological connection unlike anything that we've ever experienced. If you're in Miami, you may have noticed the construction of large poles, or in some places where they're going to put poles, but they haven't yet, and lots of wires, some of them just hanging from trees. You've got companies right now racing to get the 5G coverage set up before the Super Bowl, which happens to take place here in Miami in February. Should the city, should the county, should municipalities do more to help roll out this new technology, but do it a little bit cleaner, a little bit easier? Are we getting coverage, by the way, throughout Miami? Is everybody going to be able to enjoy 5G? Well, joining me now is Miami-Dade County Commissioner Eileen Higgins of District 5, who has expressed concerns about how this 5G rollout is happening. By the way, she's also an outspoken voice about the relief efforts in the Bahamas following Hurricane Dorian. We're going to talk about that as well. Commissioner, great to have you back. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much for having me.
Before I get to the 5G, let's talk about Dorian real quickly here. And I'm wondering, what role do you see the county playing in the assistance to those hit hardest in the Bahamas?
Well, we know we have a large Bahamian population here from the very beginning of Miami. And so I do imagine we're going to end up seeing family members and others here that are going to need to be cared for and helped. The county, under the leadership of the mayor and the commissioners, I think has just done an outstanding job. We have basically made every resource we have available to begin moving supplies over there. We've already moved almost 1 million pounds of supplies to the island. We've, of course, led our emergency rescue search and rescue teams over there. And several commissioners have actually visited. But you can see from the look in their eyes how horrible it is.
And we're going to talk later on the program. We're going to talk with a local fisherman who's helping get supplies over there. But that also leads to the question, is the Bahamian government working with you, or is just everybody's just basically, hey, we're just going to send help, however we get it there?
Well, we actually have been in contact at the county level with the Consul General of the Bahamas. So our efforts are certainly coordinated with them. We all know that in the aftermath of a disaster like this, sometimes there's kind of the getting the logistics up and running can take a little longer than we would like. But that's the nature of what's happening on the ground there with the destruction. We have additional goods. Our warehouses are still accepting donations if people would like to do that throughout the county. And we stand ready to help the Bahamian government as they need us. But we're here for the long haul. And by the way, if you don't want to donate stuff, you can donate through the United Way. We have a link on our website, miamidade.gov/cares. And that way the funding, the monetary donations can be used for what they need in the future, not just what they need now.
As everything's been playing out, it seems like help is coming from a lot of different places.
Yes.
We heard from the governor, though, this week, who said it's got to be up to the federal government. You know, that our federal government really has to do most of the chipping in.
I think that is correct. They also have a lot of control over how emergency responses happen. But the reality is our county can and should help in any way it can. Let's remember that the Bahamas helped us after Irma. So What goes around comes around. And in a disaster like this, it's our responsibility. The federal government certainly needs to play its part. But we also need to play ours.
What about this? I mean, because we're still waiting to hear from the Trump administration about the issue with visas, and will Bahamians get some form of assistance, TPS perhaps? Does the county have to wait for that, or is the county deciding, listen, we're open arms, we're going to help you out, come here?
Well, we are not, we don't control immigration. So if folks are here and they're arriving with a visa or coming through the airports, we're obviously ready to help with open arms. I did speak with Congresswoman Shalala's office earlier this morning, and there are several folks that are working up in the House of Representatives to try to make those visa requirements less stringent. And so we'll have to wait to see what happens with the federal government on that side. But certainly this is not a time where we want to be so strict that we're incapable of helping people that desperately need it.
And we have such strong economic ties between our county and the Bahamas. How has that been, I guess, disrupted with everything that's happened? And how do we help that?
I think it will take some time, but the tourism economy, obviously the fishing going back and forth, we actually have boaters going back and forth all the time. And so as the country begins, and bear in mind, parts of the Bahamas, you know, remain open, but right now all efforts are on recovery and restoring power when it can be, and making sure people have food, clothing, water, and protection from the elements. So I think it will take some time, but it's going to be as soon as the Bahamas tells us they're ready for some boating action for us to get back there. I think that it is our duty to try to do that as well.
And, you know, as you pointed out, it's true. The Bahamas are made up of many islands, and really those most impacted were Grand Bahama and Abaco. Talking again with Miami-Dade County Commissioner Eileen Higgins, representing District 5, and, you know, talking about, we were just talking about, you know, that impact of Dorian on the Bahamas, but our ties here between Miami-Dade and the Bahamian people. There's a lot of history there that goes back before the city even existed. I want to switch over now to this 5G story. And first of all, tell me, what's your understanding of 5G technology? And I mean, I keep hearing it's going to be the greatest thing in the world.
So they say. And I actually think that there's something to that story, that moving the velocity of our high-speed networks and getting it to 5G is, in the long run, going to be very beneficial. Makes us able to communicate faster. It's going to enable things like driverless cars in the future. And so there's a lot, and then there's a few industries that really need that high-speed connection, and that could make Miami-Dade County or the city of Miami more competitive in attracting some tech companies. So there could be a lot of benefits, but they are in the future. For the most part, I think the last time I read, only about 5 or 6% of Americans even own a phone that could use 5G if it was there. So we will be transitioning to 5G over the coming years. But it's certainly, putting up all these polls today does not mean the majority of us can take advantage of 5G.
All right. When did you start noticing how, you know, as these companies are coming in trying to set up, and as you said, they have to set up poles, new wiring, it's because it's a different level of technology, of connectivity, I should say. When did you start noticing, and you have pictures, and I've seen them online as well, not just the poles, in some places they started to, but that they didn't build them. You've got wires hanging on trees. You got spray paint on sidewalks of where things are going to go. When did you start seeing all this?
I've been working on this issue kind of pretty intimately or directly for probably 4 to 5 weeks now. So we began seeing much of this, particularly happening in downtown, although it's coming to the whole county. But I think because of the density of downtown, and also because Bayfront Park will end up being part of the Super Bowl celebrations, these companies really wanted to get their poles in the ground as soon as possible. But the issue was, for me, the quality of construction was horrific. They're putting the poles in, but they're not finishing the electrical work, so they're just leaving the sidewalk unrepaired. You've walked down Biscayne Boulevard today, there's just bricks strewn everywhere. They also began putting them, and this is what really made me mad, I started to see them next to historic buildings. I started to see them next to art in public places. So they put a pole 15 feet from a gorgeous statue outside of a building, when if they would have moved it another 20 feet, it would have been outside a parking garage. There's no respect for the neighbors and the neighborhood in this construction process
Was there ever a strategy on where they were going to be putting these things?
So if you're these companies, your strategy is pretty clear. Get the best possible spots. Your poles have to be every 300 feet and try to get your permits in before anybody else does so you get the best territory. So I do feel this is a little California gold rush land grab, that if you can get your poles in the ground first, no one else can get that spot. I mean, I've even seen two companies put poles within 10 feet of each other. So in an uncontrolled manner, we really can have poles in a lot of inappropriate locations.
And we talk about permits, by the way, because yes, there's a couple different things, as you said, that they have to have. It's not just the permit to put up the pole. There's an electrical permit. Correct. There's multiple things you have to do here.
Correct. So I'm becoming an expert on permitting. So first thing they have to do is receive a right-of-way permit, and that is based on who controls the street. So if it's, for example, Biscayne Boulevard, that's the Florida Department of Transportation. We also have county roads, and then we have municipal roads. So each of those three entities, if it's their street, gives a right-of-way permit, which says you can put a pole here. But you also have to have an electrical permit, and generally in municipalities, that comes from the city. So even though it may be a county road for right-of-way, the electrical permit would come from the city of Miami. So what they're doing is, if they get the right-of-way permit, they're digging up the road, the sidewalks, they're leaving them completely unrepaired, and then they don't even have an electrical permit. So I have no idea when they're going
to
come
out. So they're allowed to do that work even before they have the electrical permit?
Yes. So I have checked with our county attorney's office, and they have told us that we can begin essentially approving the permits but not issuing them until these companies have proven they also have the electrical permits as well. Bear in mind, this is very complicated because the state legislature passed a new law that basically gives local government no control over where these poles go. And we are given a specific time clock where we must approve their permits. So they just put in their permits, say, here's where I'm putting my poles. And the Florida state legislature said, sorry, local government, you have to approve them. And so we don't get a large say in this matter. So for example, I was looking at plans where there was going to be a pole right in front of the Freedom Tower. I'm like, no, that seems like a really bad idea, and I'll probably be there with a sledgehammer knocking it down, and I doubt I'm going to be alone. And so that particular company agreed to not put one there, but I have no authority to tell them they can't put it there. That's been taken away, and so I did meet with our state legislators earlier this week to ask them to please repeal this particular piece of legislation.
What about the companies themselves? How many of them have you been able to talk to discuss this?
So I have been able, which I am very pleased, I've been able to meet with all of the companies, all but one so far, to express my dismay over their construction techniques, over the fact that they do not tell anyone that they're coming. They just tear the sidewalk up. That the spray paint, oh my God, there is spray paint literally 100 different colors on every street corner. And when they're finished with their work, they do not pressure wash that spray paint off. And we know how long those sidewalk markings, another thing the state of Florida does not believe local government should control. So we have no ability to force these people to clean their paint up, even though it sometimes lasts for over a year. But it's crazy. For example, Miami World Center, brand new, right? Those two buildings just finished. Gorgeous sidewalk put in place with beautiful pavers. Just fantastic. All the upgrades we're hoping developers do. And yesterday, they just spray painted all over it. And so that means they're going to go in and tear that up, and they don't have to tell me as the commissioner, and they don't have to tell the owner of that property.
What's happening in Miami Beach, though, right now with this issue?
So Miami Beach actually, I think, was a little better than we were at least putting some design standards in place. So they have specified what these poles could and should look like. And the county, for whatever reason, 2 years ago, I wasn't there, we did not put design standards in place. So the team is now working on that because the state has not taken away our authority to say, we want metal poles, we want them to look like this, we don't want concrete poles, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, we're taking quick action to try to rectify that at the county. And I, of course, have been in conversations with the city of Miami to see if they'll do the same. So we certainly have trouble with shoddy construction, you know, and tearing up and lack of notice in Miami Beach. But their poles look, you know, if we're going to have poles everywhere, maybe they should look nice. So they do have a little bit better process.
You're going to a Miami Beach Commission
correct.
Meeting today.
Yeah, we're going to be talking about 5G. Their commissioners have some discussion about it, and so I wanted to be there in person for them. But everyone's worried that it's going up too fast and the local government is not having the time.
Do you think, though, that there's really anything you can do? Because the push here is to get this thing set up by the Super Bowl, which is in February, here in Miami, in Miami Gardens. But, you know, to get it up by that by that event and to tie it to the event because it's a big national event. It's huge. I mean, really, that's not a lot of time to be able to do much of anything.
Well, I can tell you last night I watched them put in, this was not a pole, but this was undergrounding of wires. They dug it up last night, put the manhole cover in, and they're fixing the sidewalk today. This is one of the companies that's been working very well with me, so we're going to have the sidewalk repaired today. I watched a company install a pole. It took, 5 hours. So these installations do not appear to be super timely or super complicated per pole. I'm sure all the construction people would say I'm wrong on that, but I've witnessed how quickly they go in. They can pretty much in one crew in a day install 3 poles or 3 manhole covers. So I believe that for the major areas of coverage, they can get this done. They're using the Super Bowl as an excuse to do crappy work on our streets. So I too want 5G to be available for the Super Bowl, but I do not want my sidewalks destroyed. I do not want my neighborhoods covered with spray paint. I have poles they put in the middle of the sidewalk. How is that ADA compliant? I can't have poles near art. I can't have poles near historic buildings. And so these companies could do the right thing. They're choosing not to.
The other thing, too, is this. I mean, as you said, there's a push to get it into those really condensed areas. What about everywhere else? Is 5G is going to be available to everybody?
Yes, I do believe that it is. And As I said, our area is the epicenter, but we're seeing all of these poles, other areas of my district, certainly Shenandoah, we're seeing it in Silver Bluff, and the construction is still not as pretty as it could or should be. It's coming everywhere. Commissioner Martinez mentioned he had seen one go up that also the sidewalk wasn't repaired, so they're coming to the major roads. And so it's a matter of time because they can't roll out 5G until everybody has it.
Right. You know, the other thing, too, is just thinking about coming back to this idea of because they want to get it out before the Super Bowl is done. And what I meant by, you know, what can you do in that short period of time? Yes, they could construct things quickly, but government doesn't work that fast. And the legislature isn't meeting. I mean, they're meeting in January.
No, but I'm stuck with what I've got for now, which is no control over anything. So all I can do is meet with them, beg them to do the right thing. And I'm already seeing at least one of the installation companies changing how they're working and being more accommodating. And I've basically said, if I see a dramatic improvement in how our sidewalks are treated, I might even help see why their permits are delayed. But as of now, the residents of this county do not benefit from me accelerating those permits because it just means destruction on their sidewalks, which could be right in front of their homes. So there's just going to have to be some improvement.
Before I let you go, because I think about other communities in South Florida where it's going to spread everywhere. But you know, you're talking to folks in the Keys, Fort Lauderdale, West Palm Beach. What do you tell them about getting ready for when 5G starts coming?
Well, first of all, put your design standards in place. Start drawing them now. Because then we do have control over that, and we can say to them, yes, we realize we can't tell you where to put the pole, but this is what we'd like it to look like, or how we'd like it to appear. So that would be the first thing. And I would also say, call your state legislature and just ask them to let local government have some input into the locations of these poles.
Eileen Higgins, Miami-Dade County Commissioner, District 5. Always a pleasure. Thank you so much for the time.
You're welcome. Thank you.
All right, still to come, there's a growing debate about vaping and the potential health hazards. We're going to try and better understand what it is and why young people really love this stuff. It's coming up next. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Vaping is becoming very popular. Sales are climbing. Vaping is, by the way, when you inhale nicotine or cannabis through an electronic cigarette. It's especially popular with teens. According to the Bureau of Tobacco-Free Florida statistics, 1 in 4 Florida high school students reported using vaping devices. And now there are concerns of health complications. There's a term going around right now called VAPI, or vaping-associated pulmonary injury, and it's reported to have caused 6 deaths in the U.S. so far. It has some calling for the Centers for Disease Control to do more intensive studies. One person studying the impacts is Dr. Denise Christine Vito, an assistant professor at the University of Miami School of Nursing and Health Studies. She's also an expert on the health risks of cannabis use. She's joining me now in studio. Dr. Vito, thank you so much for the time.
It's a pleasure to be here.
You know, what do you think about what do you think is behind this growing popularity of vaping? Why is it so popular?
Well, first of all, it's very accessible. You can get it almost anywhere. So I think curiosity, especially with the youth.
More than cigarettes was?
I think so, because it looks fun. It looks electronic. You can kind of do it without people seeing. They come in various shapes and sizes. Some are USBs, so you can barely see it. You could be in class and your teacher will never know.
USBs, it's like the little
thing. Yeah, that's small.
The thing that we use put in our computer. It's that tiny. We talk about the popularity. There are students that are doing it. I want to talk about high school students. I mean, you also teach a class. You've had students doing this. You've seen them do it.
Yes, I have.
I mean,
even though it's against policy, I do see it around campus. Yeah.
Why do you think students are so brazen that they'll even do it in class? I haven't even got to high schoolers yet, but I'm just curious.
I think there is that perception that it's undercover, that you can be smoking anywhere and in public and people won't know if you're doing it on an electronic device.
Now, let's remind people, though, with vaping. Okay, mm-hmm. So again, it's this electronic, they call them the vaping pens. And you're not inhaling smoke, it's a vapor, but the nicotine or cannabis could be in it. And what you're, I guess, releasing when you're breathing out is not that thick smoke we're used to seeing when somebody's smoking a cigarette, but again, it's a vapor.
Correct.
There's no smell to it, right?
Some have smells if they had added flavorings, depending on what's inside of the oil. But for the majority, it's definitely not the same smell you'd get from combustion of a regular cigarette.
So again, I'm just trying to figure out why people think that, because you could see it, why people, I guess, feel more confident that, like, I can do this anywhere now because I'm not bothering anybody.
When they first came out, it was marketed as healthier than smoking because it doesn't get as hot as combustion. So when you fire up a cigarette or a cannabis joint or blunt, the heat is beyond. It's over 400 degrees, which is combustion. Vaporizers are usually between 300 degrees, so it's below the point of combustion, but just enough to get product.
It's been around for a while. It's not that it's new, but this term vapey and these complications, and now we're seeing again, we're now at 6 deaths that have been reported sort of related to this issue. But what's happening right now that's bringing this question to the forefront like this, and why we're seeing these complications?
I think physicians and clinicians are starting to see more patients that are reporting the electronic cigarette use or cannabis use. And so since it's becoming more common, the symptoms are becoming more prevalent.
You're doing a number of studies on this issue, in part, right?
Correct.
Tell me a little bit about what those studies are.
All right. Well, I have a few studies. All of them are cannabis related. The one that's the most relevant, I would say, is what we're doing now, comparing those who ingest cannabis through vape pens versus a blunt, which is basically rolling it in a tobacco leaf, versus the traditional joint, which is just a piece of paper. And what I'm seeing is there are differential effects in health based on how they use cannabis.
And, I mean, is it worse, you know, if you're using the electronic pen compared to the other two forms?
We're currently analyzing the data still, but I will say there is a difference. And I will say that the majority of those who are vaping, in my studies at least, are the patients. So they're being told that it's healthier than if they want to use cannabis. So if they're using cannabis for pain or anxiety relief, their suggestion would be, okay, don't smoke it. Instead, go to a vape shop or go somewhere and get a vaporizer because it's quote unquote healthy. And those are exact words from patients that I've seen.
One of the studies that you're also doing, another one is, I mean, you had asked people just, you know, their what they know and understand about vaping, right? And they told you that they thought it was healthier, right?
Yes, they say it. And in fact, one of my publications is under review now, and I've quoted them. They say that it's healthier and that they much rather vape than smoke any day.
That vaping is healthier? It's healthier than smoking, is what they're saying.
Is what they believe.
Where did they get that?
I think just asking around, and even their physician, not even physicians, but the people who give cannabis cards, for example. It could be almost anyone, and just depends.
Now, is vaping healthier than smoking?
That's the million-dollar question, and unfortunately, I don't have the answer. I don't think anyone has the answer at this point.
What is the CDC saying about, first of all, what do they say about just vaping in general? Have they had any statement on this?
Yes, actually, at the end of last month, they released a statement warning everyone of the potential hazards of vaporizing tobacco or cannabis. And in fact, they said children, pregnant women are the main populations that should stay away from e-cigarettes.
And obviously, there's been call for the CDC to do more research. Have they said anything about why they haven't done that yet?
I think it's a lot more than just being able to do research. You have funding, you have to get approved, and so it's definitely going to take time to do proper, rigorous research that's needed.
Now, see, this comes back to the studies that you've been doing. One of the interesting things is, I mean, because, look, marijuana is still federally illegal, and so there isn't the money, or the government does not want to spend the money on any research for it. Does that cause a problem for you and your ability to do any kind of study on this?
It certainly causes complications, especially since it's an illegal substance federally. But I would say there are funding mechanisms from the NIH, National Institute of Health, that does provide opportunities for researchers like me to get ahead of the topic.
When we come back to this idea, as you said, you've heard from people telling you that they think it's healthier. When you talk to people, how exactly do you get around that? What do you say to people about that?
Well, first, I always ask why. Why do you think it's healthier? And the majority of patients that I see say, well, you're not smoking it. You're not putting fire to it. So I don't know if it's this assumption that you need the fire to be unhealthy. But the general consensus that I found is that they just think it's, since they're not combusting per se, they assume it's healthier.
Again, talking with Dr. Denise Christine Vito, an assistant professor at the University of Miami School of Nursing and Health Studies. And we're talking about vaping, and it's becoming very popular. And as I pointed out earlier, statistics show, especially with high schoolers, but we've also seen a series of complications with people getting sick, having pulmonary problems, and there have been 6 deaths related to this issue. We'd like to hear from you. Do you vape, and why? Do you prefer it over smoking? Do you think it's healthier? And if you're a parent, how are you talking to your kids about vaping? Find us on social media on Twitter or Facebook at WLRN Sundial. We'd love to hear your thoughts on that. Dr. Vito, there was this comment from Matt Jordan. He's the Florida Director of Government Relations for the American Cancer Society, Cancer Action Network, excuse me. He said the following, quote, "The consequence of that inaction has led to potential product manipulation and permitted tobacco companies to lure a new generation with electronic cigarette advertising, such as flavors and so forth. The part that jumped out at me, potential product manipulation. This is something you were telling me about, which is these electric pens use a cartridge. That cartridge has an oil that is basically what you're vaping. That's what you're inhaling.
Correct.
People are putting whatever they want into that cartridge, though.
That seems to be what's occurring, yes.
Do you think this is what's leading to this, the issue we see now with a lot of more people getting sick and even these deaths? Is it the manipulation?
I think for sure more research needs to be done before I can say definitely either way. But what I can say is that of the cases that I've seen and I've been reading about them, they have mentioned that manipulation. And even the patients that I know, they will say, oh, I get my legal medicinal cannabis pen from a legal dispensary. However, it's so expensive. So moving forward, I then just kind of put what I can in there. What can I afford?
What are they doing? What are they putting in there?
It just depends. They can try to make their own oils, their own cannabis oils, not realizing that there's a specific type of concentrate that's used for those. So they can, make their own oils at home. They can get it from the gas stations, even certain places. So it's very accessible, and that leads to a public health crisis.
The other thing, too, I'd seen is that there may be a connection with an issue with vitamin E in these pens. What's the connection? What does that mean? I don't understand.
Correct. I saw that some, not all, but some of the cases reported that additive. And that's one of the problems with vaping. You don't know what's in there. And if it's not regulated, I always say not all cannabis is created equal. And I can say the same about vaporizing pens. We don't know who's creating them, what kind of ingredients, byproducts, fillers, flavoring. We just don't know if it's unregulated.
If the CDC were to do any kind of research into this, how long would it take? I mean, do you have to follow a group of people over a long period of time to see what health issues may come up because of vaping? Do we have to have that kind of sample?
As an epidemiologist, one of the major rules of thumb is we can't talk about causation until we do a longitudinal type study or a randomized control trial. So right now we're kind of in outbreak phase. So we're trying to investigate and catch up to the news, catch up to the science. But ideally, a longitudinal study would be best because then we can see the cases as they occur and we can see exactly what were those exposures. So what exact pen were they using, et cetera.
So right now at this stage, what can you say about vaping and if there are health risks?
I would say based on the research that's currently out there, there is a differential effect, health effect, based on your route of administration, and to use caution.
Coming back to the issue of cannabis, by the way, I wondered what advice do you tell people who are using right now medical marijuana as to where they're getting, because you mentioned it a second ago, sometimes they say it's too expensive, so I just got to find whatever I can. But I'm wondering what, if you're telling people, at this point, what their options are, where should they not be looking for this stuff?
Well, certainly the most ideal place to get it would be a legalized,
right,
regulated source. So we have dispensaries here in South Florida. But the question of where do they actually get it? As I mentioned before, literally people are saying gas stations, online, Groupon just had a sale for vape pens. So the accessibility is very wide.
Where do you see this going? I mean, the popularity of these things is growing. We see the statistics, especially with high schoolers. And if there's no studies out there, where do you see this going? Where do we go from here?
It's great that you asked that question. Literally just yesterday in class, I teach Introduction to Epidemiology, and I use this as an example of what happened with lung cancer. In lung cancer, with tobacco products, they were widely available. Then we had this large lung cancer prevalence incidence. Now, electronic cigarettes, widely available, quote unquote healthier. What's going to happen 10 years from now, 5 years from now?
What do you say, and I don't know if you've had the chance to talk to schools, but, public schools, high schools especially, what do you say to them about how they should be approaching this issue?
Well,
because I'd imagine if you've got students doing it in your class, they're probably doing it in some classrooms or at least in the hallways,
mm-hmm.
Yes.
I've given some nonprofit prevention talks, but I haven't spoken to administration. However, I am a parent in Broward County, and my daughter is in elementary school, and we received a call literally 3 days ago from the school board saying vaping is a health concern. Children will be disciplined accordingly.
And what's the discipline going to be?
It ranged based on age range, but they listed from 6 to 12, in-class suspension, out-of-school suspension, substance use programming. So obviously the schools are noticing now that it's an issue. And if my daughter's in elementary school and I'm getting this message, I don't know.
You know, the other thing, I mean, with smoking for so many years, we always kept talking about secondhand smoke and the possible dangers. You know, is that question even come up? Is that something that would also be part of the study? Is there an issue with secondhand vape?
That is certainly something that should be studied. I don't know offhand of anyone that's studying that right now, but considering the vapor that comes out may have byproducts, I can only imagine what secondhand can do.
How would you talk to parents? You yourself are a parent. Okay, so you hear from the schools and they're telling you this is happening, this is an issue, but how do you talk to parents about the issue of smoking, but also just the issue of vaping? Because what I'm getting from things that I'm reading is that there's just a coolness that goes with vaping. This is why a lot of people are, you know, even these vape pens, they're selling them, they're designed, they've got all these designs and they have different looks to them and so forth. But I don't know, what is that approach? How does that conversation start with parents?
I think at this point, with it being so widely publicly available, and especially with the news talking about a lot, now is the perfect time to just innocently speak to your child and say, hey, I've heard this on the news. Have you heard about this? And just get their conversations. And if they say that they are engaging, then try to find ways to get them not to.
Now, you're a mom. Your kids are still very young. But
yeah.
At what point do you think you're going to have that conversation? And what are you going
to
do?
To be completely honest with you, with my daughter, I'd have it as soon as I hear it in school. So luckily, I haven't heard her talking about anything in school, but I would assume by fourth or fifth grade. And the research that I've done research all the way from prenatal to adolescence, you know, and I've heard crazy things as young as five. So at this point, I think knowledge is important and communication is more important.
Talking again with Dr. Denise Christine Vito, an assistant professor at the University of Miami School of Nursing and Health Studies, talking about this issue of vaping. And again, we want to hear from you. How much do you know about vaping? And if you're doing it, tell us why you do it. Do you think it's healthy? Because we talked about that a little while ago. And also, if you're a parent, how are you talking to people? We did hear from some of you. Emily tweeted at us, started smoking at 15, now 31, and just switched to vaping because of social pressure and ostracization of smokers. My lungs have never felt worse. Glad I'm not smoking, but I wish nicotine replacement therapy options like gum was cheaper and more available. We also heard from Paul. I am someone who vapes. It was recommended by a doctor. Is there contaminated products that are in these e-cigs? I've never heard of that. First of all, that a doctor would tell somebody that this is a better option?
I mean, in the cannabis field, I can speak to more
yes.
than the tobacco field. But in cannabis, it is, especially in Florida. Florida, if you look at our legalization of medical cannabis, in the beginning, only vaporizing and tinctures were available, or pills. So if those were the legal methods, then as a patient, what do you think is okay?
There is still a lot to learn about this issue. There's no question
sure.
about that. Dr. Vito, such a pleasure. Thank you.
Yes, thank you for your time.
Thank you for the education. I know a little bit more now. All right, still to come, we're going to meet a local fisherman who has been taking his own crew out to the Bahamas to get supplies to those in need. That's coming up next on Sundial. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, Hurricane Dorian made a direct hit on the Abaco Islands and Grand Bahama more than a week ago. The slow-moving hurricane was the most powerful storm on record to strike the Bahamas, and that storm left many with nothing. Bahamian officials are trying to get help to those folks, but there are limitations. Here in South Florida, a half dozen fishermen wanted to help, and they felt that maybe the Bahamian government was moving too slow. They wanted to take matters in their own hands. We've heard these stories. People who are not waiting. They want to get help, and they got the means to get it there, and they're going to do it. Well, by Friday, on the first week of September, professional fisherman Tim Maddock and a fishing team did take some stuff out to those in need, and he joins me now. Tim, thanks so much. I really appreciate the time.
Absolutely.
Tell me at what point did you, because let's clarify, you went with a team of people. It wasn't just you by yourself. You went with a team of people on a boat, right?
Right.
Whose boat was it, by the way?
My next door neighbor, Danny Massa, another fishing team from the fishing community. Their boat's called D&D Fishing Team.
Yeah.
You know, we were watching the storm, you know, are we going to get it? We knew the Bahamas were going to get it. So you know, it was the quick shift from, okay, we're in the clear, to now we got to help these people.
Yeah. You've been a fisherman, by the way, a long time.
Yes.
And you know the Bahamas really well.
Yes.
Now, you got a lot of friends over there?
Not so much, more in Lakaya than like the Abacos.
Yeah.
I've got a lot of friends that spend a lot of time in the Abacos and, you know, Marsh Harbor and all that. They've got houses there, a lot of good friends there. So through that whole stretch of islands, you know, there's a lot of friends, a lot of family, you know, a lot of memories that you keep seeing people on, you know, social media talking about the memories. And, you know, that's kind of what in our world, you know, got us going. And, you know, we got to help these people as fast as we can.
Yeah. When did that conversation start? Like, all right, guys, let's go. We got to send some stuff. We got to help.
I would say, I mean, obviously we were talking about, you know, as soon as the smoke clears, we're out of here, you know, we're going to go help. And I think that went into fast forward. It went from Tuesday, Wednesday talking about it to, okay, we're on our way to Costco, we're on our way to Lowe's, we're on our way to Home Depot, you know, Walmart to get whatever we, you know, this was, I think, before all the donations were made, all the contributions were made, where now on every corner, there's a stack of stuff to bring over there.
Right.
You know, water, food, you know, medical supplies. And it was, you know, Thursday night, let's go, let's just go get as much stuff as we can fit on the boat. And we did. And Friday morning, you know, we took off for the first run. The weather was awesome, you know, thank God. So it was a nice crossing and, you know, didn't really know what to expect. You know, we knew we wanted to get this stuff in the right hands.
Yeah.
There was already people talking about the cruise ships going and, you know, but that's a whole process. How do you get stuff from a cruise ship to the Bahamas where the roads are blocked and the you know, there's no transportation means. And, you know, so that's a whole nother story. But, you know, we wanted to get there. We wanted to go to the harbors that we knew, to the docks that we knew, to the people that we knew, and physically give the stuff to them.
You know, I mean, I haven't been there, but all I've seen are just all these photos online, and it's so sad. But I'm wondering, like, when you got there, where are you docking? How are you getting in? Because it looked like everything was just destroyed.
That's more, again, out to the east, okay. And in the Abacos, and in Freeport, in Lakaya. In fact, I was telling some of the other people, when we were running down the coastline before we come into Port Lakaya, it didn't even look like there was a storm there.
Wow.
So not knowing what to expect and then seeing everything look like a normal Friday, so to speak. And,
yeah.
You know, we came into the cut and it was the same thing. Still, for the most part, looked normal. A couple broken docks and, you know, it was way more from storm surge than from wind, the damage that we saw. Mm. So, but we knew there was more than what we were seeing, you know? So we got in there, we went to, you know, some of the docks that we had arranged with people, you know, to get stuff to them, and they were going to transport it out east, you know, which was where the worst stuff was.
Yeah.
That was the first trip. And then the second trip, we met the guys there as well. And my buddy who has a house in Lakaya, his neighbor didn't have anything. The flood wiped everything out. She's a local Bahamian and she needed Pampers and flip-flops and, you know, first aid stuff and all that stuff for kids. And we made a bunch of stuff for her that we dropped off to her. And then we got in a truck and drove around a little bit. And that's when we really saw what, again, nothing like they got out east or in the Abacos. But that's when we saw what, depending on who you listen to, 10, 15, 20, 25 feet of storm surge. You know, we walked through a couple houses and it was... These are concrete houses.
Right.
You know, Freeport, there's a little bit more money.
Yeah.
So they're concrete houses and they were still just, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I heard stories of people like, because the water came in, filled it all the way up to the ceiling. They had to climb up on the roof just to get away from that. And then you deliver the goods and then what, it was just a get right back and make more trips?
That's what we did. That's, you know, again, Friday we were... we saw a couple boats coming and going across, but very few. You heard on social media that Saturday was going to be the day when, you know, less people are working and whatnot. So Friday we pretty much dropped off and turned around and came home, you know, didn't really get on land much at all, just on the seawall and the dock to unload. you know, shook everybody's hands. Everybody was extremely grateful. And then, you know, Saturday we met with the same people. They told us how much of a hit a bunch of the stuff was that they got out, you know, the flip-flops. We went to Walmart, bought 150 pairs of flip-flops and handed them out. And, you know, it's everything washed away. They got no shoes.
Right.
They can't even start to walk around with all the debris and everything. So it was all this stuff like that that we know got to the right people, was a big hit, and it was doing something.
You know, because you bring it in, and I know that I've been trying to get answers to this from different people, like supplies come in, and then to make sure it gets to the right people, like you're giving it to somebody, they're taking it. You know, do you know where it's going?
With what we were doing, yes.
Okay.
Because we know the people that we were giving it to.
Gotcha.
We're all on the same team. You know, they... You know, and again, here's some water for you. Here's some Gatorades for your family. You know, this has got to get distributed. And we were getting texts the whole Friday night from these guys. Man, you know, these people, we couldn't get any further than this because of the roads are damaged or, you know, debris blocking the roads. And then by Saturday, they must have cleared it up a little bit because they were telling us they could get further, you know, and get stuff to more people. So we weren't, you know, we were as confident as you can get that it was getting to the right people.
Again, I'm talking with Tim Maddock. He's a professional fisherman, and he went with a fishing team. He's taken a couple of trips there to the Bahamas to get supplies to people. And we've been hearing again about a lot of different groups and individuals here in South Florida. They have the means, whether it's a plane or boat, and getting supplies to those places to people who really need it. And we'd love to hear from you if you're doing that. You know, what's that effort like for you? And what are some of the experiences you've had? Find us on Facebook or Twitter and let us know. Share your story with us. Find us at WLRN Sundial. You know, talking about like in these kind of situations, governments try to coordinate how supplies get around. And I wondered, have you run into Bahamian government officials? Have you run into the Coast Guard? Has anybody said to you, that's fine, keep doing what you're doing, or don't do this, we have a certain way of doing it?
A good friend of mine that's been back and forth to Treasure K several times on his plane, he put something on Facebook that really hit, and he said, if you don't see it with your own eyes, please don't post anything about it. Good, bad, or indifferent, whether it's security reasons. I mean, there was people saying the looters shot down a Coast Guard helicopter.
Right.
So, and we went through something like that on Saturday night. One of my buddy's boats supposedly got hijacked and held at gunpoint and all that. And 8 hours later, we found out it was 100% rumor. So, you know, we were hands-on involved with from midnight to 8 o'clock in the morning, not knowing if our friends were still alive. So, what he basically said is, you know, if you don't see it, you know, the government's going to do what they're going to do. You know, people are trying from here. Everybody's trying. And yeah, there's going to be some red tape and there's going to be some ropes and hurdles, but they need the supplies. They're not going to make it without it. And I just think, you know, if you listen to all of it, you're not going to know what to do. I think there's a lot of people out there that are trying to help. I think it's better now after a week's gone by and a lot of boats have gone over there. In the beginning, I think, you know, everybody was scared. Nobody knew what to do. You look at the big scheme of things, we're on a 30-foot boat or a 40-foot boat or a 50-foot boat, and you bring enough supplies to fill half of this room. There's 70,000 people homeless right now.
Yeah.
It's going to last 2 minutes. But every little bit helps.
Yeah.
So, you know, you hope that you bring it to the right place. You hope that it gets unloaded the right way, and you hope that at least a good portion of it goes to the right people.
Real quickly, this is interesting point too. Is it's hard to believe then anything that you're seeing because you don't know if the story's true. I don't know. Is it hard right now? Basically, do you just feel like I can't believe any of this stuff?
I don't know. I mean, it's depending on what you're referring to. So,
and because you had the story where somebody's telling you that a friend,
right,
his boats is hijacked, and you didn't know for hours.
Right, right. So again, I've taken the videos I took, and I didn't even post them. There's enough drama. There's enough tragedy. There's enough red tape. Let it be what it's going to be.
Yeah.
you know, we're just going to keep trying to do the right thing, and hopefully it helps.
Tim, are you going to take any other trips anytime soon?
I'm sure we will be. Yeah. I'm not planning going tomorrow, but I'm sure we'll be back.
Tim Maddock, again, professional fisherman here in South Florida. You know, him and friends doing what they can to get supplies out to the Bahamas. Lots of people doing that. Tim, I know they appreciate that. But thank you so much for sharing. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Well, that's our program for this Wednesday, September 11th. Sundial is produced by Chris Remington and Alejandro Martinez. Our intern is Sherilyn Cabrera. Our engagement editor is Katie Lepre. Teresa Frontado is our digital director. Our news director is Terrence Shepard. Alicia Zuckerman is our editorial director. And our WLRN program director is Jason Zapka. Peter J. Merritt's pushing all the buttons. Well, before I get into tomorrow's program, related to the conversation we had earlier today about the concerns surrounding vaping, it was just announced that the Trump administration is now considering a ban on the sale of flavored e-cigarettes. This is a story that we'll continue to follow. Coming up tomorrow on Sundial, by the way, WLRN's Danny Rivera will be hosting. You're going to hear part of a conversation with Democratic Congresswoman Debbie Mercosal-Powell. She'll explain plans to help the Bahamas. Plus, we'll learn about changes in immigration law going into effect within the next few weeks. And finally, we're going to learn about a book from hundreds of years ago documenting the incredible plants and fruits of Cuba from the early 1800s. This is a National Geographic special. That's all coming up tomorrow on the program. Find us again on Facebook, WLRN Sundial. I'm Luis Hernandez. Have a wonderful day. We'll talk to you tomorrow.